Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find more information on the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is the fourth in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship in America. I am Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club and a moderator for today's program. In fact, a moderator for all the social entrepreneurship programs. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Christopher Gergen. After meeting Christopher and reading his CV, there was no doubt in my mind that he is an extraordinary overachiever. Here are some of the titles and tasks he is currently working on. He is a founding partner of Life Entrepreneurs, a leadership development and consulting firm. He is co-author of Life Entrepreneurs, Ordinary People, Creating Extraordinary Lives. He is a visiting lecturer and director of the Entrepreneurial Leadership Initiative at Duke University and is the innovator in residence at the Center for Creative Leadership. Christopher is also spearheading a community-led effort called Bull City Forward to establish Durham, North Carolina, as a national model of economic development through social innovation and entrepreneurship, the centerpiece of which is a downtown social innovation campus enabling local entrepreneurs to create world-changing solutions. I'm sure we'll hear more about this exciting initiative during our program today. Amazingly, Christopher does all these, including being a father of two, without compromise on quality or excellence. It is because he can offer the practitioner, the academic, the grassroots, and the big picture perspectives that we've asked him to be part of this series and add much to the discourse on social entrepreneurship. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Christopher Gergen.
So it's great to be here. Thanks very much, Ruth, and thanks very much for having me here at the Commonwealth Club. And I'm pleased to also welcome our KQED listeners and the Fora TV watchers to this program. And I'm looking forward to an engaging conversation. And I must tell you that I do not normally stand behind podiums or sit behind tables. So I'm going to have to adjust slightly to this, and I may wander among you in the audience. When I was thinking about this talk and being able to spend some time together and thinking about all the other distinguished people who have been part of the Social Entrepreneurship in America gathering, I was thinking about what are the various things that I really wanted to try and bring to the table in terms of this conversation. And I thought it'd be helpful to start with a personal story. And then as we moved from the personal to try and get into some of my observations in terms of the work that I do both at Duke and also in the field that I'm working on with regards to Durham and North Carolina and some of the economic development activities that I see happening actually globally, given a lot of the work that we're doing. So briefly, in terms of a personal story, so I grew up in Washington, D.C., and ended up going down to school at Duke University. And upon graduating, I had had a variety of different eclectic, some would say, and especially my parents would say, bohemian experiences. And yet, when I graduated, I had many, many questions about sort of where I was going and what I was going to do. And I decided to follow a tried and true path in my family, which is that of journalism. And I went to the last job that my parents could easily explain to their friends, which is I went to go work for CNN. And it felt very safe for them that I could work at CNN because they could easily explain it to their friends, right? Our son works at CNN. Oh, great. That's so fantastic. That's the last time they've ever been able to do that successfully. Now they say, I'm not really sure. You're going to have to talk to him. But after about a year, let me tell you one opening or awakening experience that I had, which is that while I was at Duke, I was very engaged in looking at how macro politics were playing themselves out, and I really wanted to go to the front lines of those conversations. And so I actually went and spent a year in South Africa, close to a year in South Africa, in 1992. So I was there right when apartheid was being dismantled. Mandela, of course, had been released from prison in 1990. I was there for the last all-white referendum and was very actively engaged in a lot of the political discussions in both the coursework, because I was studying politics at the University of Cape Town, as well as in the field. I was actually working with an organization called the Student Health and Welfare Community Organization, which is the largest student community organization in the world. And it works throughout South Africa, but mostly in Cape Town and squatter camps and townships. And I helped start there an adult literacy program and was very actively involved in a lot of the conversations that were happening in South Africa. Well, flash forward 2 years later, and I'm at CNN, and I started at the very bottom rung of the totem pole. But I worked my way by hook and crook into a writing position at Headline News. And I was writing about the election of Nelson Mandela to president of South Africa. And to me, it was actually a depressing moment. It was depressing because I was behind a computer monitor writing about this and not in South Africa celebrating it. And I realized at that moment in time that I needed to get my ass out of, that I need to get myself out of behind a computer monitor in Atlanta and down to a place that I really felt like I could affect change. And I'd spent some time in Africa, and I was really keen to learn about a new culture, a new language. And so with that, I took off, took my limited savings, and spent a year traveling through Latin America. And I was specifically interested in how we might be able to harness the technology I had been working with at CNN towards education development. In another life, I had also spent 4 months hitchhiking around New Zealand and Australia with very little money in my pocket and ended up working as a school teacher on a farm in New Zealand where I fell in love with teaching. So it was the combination between this technology and education and wanting to get actively involved in this conversation that I found myself down in Santiago, Chile. And when I got to Santiago, fell in love with it. I loved the outdoors. It was an opportunity for me to get to the mountains a number of different times. But it was also a land just like South Africa had been, of tremendous change. So Pinochet had been deposed in 1989. The country was beginning to awaken to some of its creative, entrepreneurial roots. And I felt like it was a place I could really do some exciting things. Because there had been times where I had been in other parts of Latin America. At one point, for example, I was hitchhiking between the border of Guatemala and Honduras. And I was invited by a family to come spend some time with them on this banana plantation. And I had this very surreal experience because I went and spent the night with them. And this was a family that had 6 children. None of them were literate. All of them were sleeping on cardboard boxes. They had no running water, and yet they had a television. And that evening, we spent watching reruns of Dynasty. You can imagine how the absolute disconnect being with all these children who were working on the farm every day, who were coming home to watch reruns of Dynasty, felt criminal to me. And yet, Guatemala and Honduras at the time just didn't have the infrastructure to be able to really create new solutions to be able to address those. Well, in Chile, I felt we did. And in fact, shortly upon arriving, purely because I went and knocked on the door of the largest television network down there and explained a vision that I had for distance education, that they explained that they were thinking about the same kind of thing and why don't I join them on this journey. So I started working for Canal 13, which is the largest television network down there, developing distance education programming for them. And I also saw another great opportunity. Remember, I had nothing to lose at this point in time. I had no money, so I needed a job. And I had a backpack, and I had a very rudimentary working knowledge of Spanish. But yet, I knew enough to know that there were thousands upon thousands of young people on the streets of Santiago, most of them on the plazas and on the corners. And I also knew enough at the great age of 24 to realize an opportunity, which I saw one, which is that there were no cool places for these young people to hang out. In fact, most of the bars were brightly lit and had bad beer. And I thought, we can do better than this. So, again, nothing to lose. I ended up raising $40,000 of local investment, recruiting a team of Chilean actors and artists to join me on this quixotic journey to create the first coffee house bar restaurant in Santiago. And we had an absolute blast putting this thing together. And at one point, I was on top of the world, as you might imagine, filled with a certain sense of 24-year-old hubris. Because I had arrived in this city with nothing but a backpack, and within a few short months, I had not only my own bar, I had an apartment, and I had a bicycle. So I thought I was, the cat's meow at that point in time. And I would be racing across the city from meeting to meeting on my bicycle, trying to meet with as many people as I could. And one of the people that I met with was very quiet, and I hadn't really been told much about his story. I should have done a little bit more research. So I launch into my whole story about how I'm trying to launch this cafe, and I eventually take a breath, and I ask him what he's done, and this guy had started his own university. So he quickly put me in my place. He had grown from two classrooms of 25 students each to 5,000 students over the course of a few short years. A remarkable man. And he and I established a real relationship and a friendship, and he became a mentor of mine. And during our conversations at one point, I asked him what he called himself, because I was curious. I mean, this is a man that I wanted to emulate. And he called himself un empresario cultural, a cultural entrepreneur. And for me, that is when the clouds parted, where I felt like all of a sudden I had seen my destiny, because I had just had this incredible experience of opening this bar. I loved being an entrepreneur, but I also came to appreciate, as much as I loved having an ADC restaurant, a rotating art gallery, live music 7 nights a week, I also appreciated that at the end of the day, it was a bar, that we were limiting sort of our social impact to that space. And I felt that I was called to do more than that. I was thinking back to my time in South Africa and my connection with Nelson Mandela, and felt like there was something bigger for me out there, and that entrepreneurship was going to be that path. And specifically, that being an education entrepreneur was going to be that path. And so I started formulating this idea of what an education entrepreneur might look like and what I could do when I came back to the States to try and become that education entrepreneur. And so I wrote furiously long treatises on sort of the future of American education. And with some reluctance, even though I had this vision of where I wanted to go, I ended up selling my bar. Because I realized a couple of different things. One is I wanted to pursue this path, and two, I didn't feel like I had the skills to be able to do it justice at that moment in time. So I came back to do graduate work with a specific focus on being an education entrepreneur. I did a master's in public policy with a focus in education and an MBA. And I got deeply involved in charter schools. So those of you who know what charter schools are, essentially they are public schools. But they are autonomous in the way that they are structured and created and run. And it allows for a tremendous amount of entrepreneurial vision. And you see some great charter school models that have emerged. Of course, you might be familiar with KIPP and Green Dot, Aspire, to name a few that have been very actively engaged in California. When I was in graduate school, I felt like I couldn't wait to be an education entrepreneur. And I felt like one of the things that was missing was actually working with young people and giving them the tools and the skills and the mentoring so they too could be social entrepreneurs. They too could be education entrepreneurs or whatever they chose to be. Because I felt like in high schools, we were just not entering into this conversation. It was one of the things that was absolutely missing from the conversation. It was all about your basic fundamentals. But it wasn't about the critical thinking to be thinking about how do you connect the dots, become a problem solver. And so I started a little nonprofit organization teaching leadership, entrepreneurship, and service in high school. And I would teach every Wednesday morning before school began. And these students would come to my class, and they would receive no credit. And they would come at 7 a.m., and I'd come at 7 a.m., and there were often mornings when it was dark and raining. I'm like, what in the heck am I doing? But every time, it was a really, they kept you on your toes, so you could be doing the craziest stuff, and every time they would hold your feet to the fire to make sure you were delivering something of quality in the classroom. I loved teaching, and I also wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I did it for 15 years. So that's a thread you'll hear in my life and in my work. But when I graduated from business school in 1998, of course, that was a terrific time to start a new company. And I was excited and interested, and this will be maybe a conversation that we can have together, about starting something scalable. And of course, in 1998, going into 1999, that was a time when private equity investment was readily available for two guys in a business plan. And so that's exactly what we set out to do. I ended up meeting my co-founder, actually, when we were both being recruited by the Department of Education to help them on their distance education work, and ultimately decided, the two of us, that we didn't want to go into government, that we wanted to go off and start our own thing. And we started a company called Smart Thinking, which is an online tutoring company. And the concept behind Smart Thinking is that we provide 24/7 access to high-quality academic support to university students. And the business model essentially is that the universities pay Smart Thinking to provide this service for free to their students. I'm not going to get into too much detail, but it's been a wild ride. But we've now grown that company into the market leader in the U.S. We serve about 1,000 universities and about 200,000 students now in terms of the work that we do. And it's been a wonderful experience to try and bring a company like that to scale. And I continue to serve on that company's board. I've also followed my own entrepreneurial path. I'm a starter, you'll hear. In fact, Bull City Forward, that Ruth has mentioned and I'm going to speak about in a second, is my seventh startup, just by way of context. I can't help myself. I feel like it's a serial entrepreneur. My wife and my parents call it ADD. But the idea behind Smart Thinking was to get this up and off the ground, but as soon as it turned into more of selling tutoring again and again and again and again, that I lost my interest in it and wandered off to another entrepreneurial venture, which was a friend of mine was running AmeriCorps Vista at the time. Some of you may be familiar with AmeriCorps Vista and Vista. And neat concept to launch something called the Entrepreneur Corps, where we placed 400 business volunteers and 96 nonprofits for a year of service to be able to basically build out their capacity and their business acumen to be able to serve more clients better and be able to deepen their impact in the world. And I've stayed on that entrepreneurial path, mostly in the education sector, helping to found a charter school and a few other things. But one of the things I want to focus on is that over the course of my practicing being an entrepreneur and my teaching of being an entrepreneur, I began to notice a few different things. One is that I began to notice that there were certain patterns to entrepreneurship, that over the course of me starting a bar and an online tutoring company and a charter school and a government initiative and a little nonprofit organization, that there was a pattern to what it took to get a new enterprise off the ground. The other thing I began to appreciate is the fact that that pattern wasn't necessarily relegated to a business or a nonprofit organization. That pattern actually was something that I began to see in people who were doing truly extraordinary things in their lives. And they weren't necessarily entrepreneurs. They could be intrapreneurs. They could be ballet dancers. They could be artists. They could have this creative spirit to them. But one way or another, these were people who had ultimately taken a very intentional and purposeful path in their life. Because one of the things you will notice about entrepreneurship, and one of the things that business schools are struggling with right now, is that entrepreneurship is ultimately illogical, right? Because ultimately you have to depart from something that is safe and secure. And you've got to go follow something that you ultimately feel deep down is the right path for you to go down, right? Leaving CNN was against my parental expectation, my peer pressure, my girlfriend pressure. There was a lot of stuff holding me back from going to Atlanta. I mean, leaving Atlanta. But yet there was something that was calling me, a larger, higher calling, a passionate calling. And I felt like that story needed to be told. And in fact, that story should be shared with people who are not necessarily going to ultimately become entrepreneurs. These stories should be shared with all people who are in the process of figuring out how they themselves can live a more purposeful life. And so with the encouragement of a mentor that my good friend Peter Sims and I share, is in Warren Bennis. Some of you may know from his work at the University of Southern California and for some of his terrific work in leadership, especially for the seminal book on becoming a leader. He encouraged me to ultimately write a book about it. And I got to tell you that writing a book, the prospect of writing a book, went against every grain in my body, because it requires you to sit down in a quiet place and not talk to many people for a long time and write and think and reflect. But one of the great things about that process, of course, is just like teaching, is you have to organize your thoughts. And you have to be logical and thoughtful about how that's going to work. Now, the only way we were going to be able to pull this off, of course, and I recruited the way I normally do, I love to try and do things in collaboration with others. And again, it will be a theme that I'm going to talk about in a second, is that I really wanted to bring somebody else into this. I recruited a good friend of mine, Greg Vanerick, to join me in this journey. And he and I ended up interviewing 55 people who we thought had really created extraordinary lives for themselves and tried to get to what were the key things that we could learn out of their own experiences. And so over 1,000 pages of transcripts later, we ended up distilling it into what we felt were really important components of what the entrepreneurial life path was. And I'm going to share just a few of those ideas, and then I want to transfer into a key thing that I've learned since that time. So the people who have really done extraordinary things in their lives, and again, these are life entrepreneurs. This is the concept of the book. And these are not people who are necessarily starting new businesses or nonprofit organizations. But the people who are life entrepreneurs, people who are leading truly extraordinary lives and living very intentional lives, have the same things in common. One, they have a very clear understanding of who they are as people. They have a deep sense of what their core identity is. They also are awake to the opportunities that are around them. So that, as Carlos Castaneda likes to talk about, there are cubic centimeters of chance around us all the time, right? But you have to be a warrior to have the speed and the prowess to pick it up. Life entrepreneurs have that speed, have that prowess to pick up those opportunities. The third thing they have to do is they have to be able to translate that opportunity into a vision of what the future should look like, right? Entrepreneurs believe that the future is malleable, to quote Mark Andreessen, right? That the world is not fated, that we have the ability to look out on the horizon and create a new future for ourselves and for our communities and for our world. In fact, our world is dependent upon this entrepreneurial spirit. But you have to have a vision to be able to drive that forward, because once you have a vision, then you can develop a set of goals and strategies to be able to get there, right? Because you can begin to realize where the gaps are. I'm here. Here's my core identity. I want to go here. What do I need to do in order to pull that off, right? In small ways, small bets along the way, and get those early wins and get some confidence and build momentum. But the only way you're going to be able to build that momentum is if you have a strong support network. And there are three characteristics that we saw in terms of a really healthy support network. One is deep trust, right? These are people who are in your personal board of directors. Deep trust with them is important. Two is it's diverse, right? Getting a diverse set of perspectives so that when you have a hard challenge you're trying to face, it's not necessarily going and talking to your mom and three sisters about what the problem is and what you're trying to do to solve it, right? It's talking to people from a wide range of backgrounds who might be able to offer different set of perspectives into it. The third thing is it's reciprocal, right? So it's trusting. It's got a certain amount of perspective that's brought by the diversity, and it's reciprocal. It's paying it forward, helping each other out along the way. The other thing that's really important is that ultimately you have to take that illogical path. You have to assume that measure of risk when you go for it. So it was really interesting. When we were talking to people, and I talk to audiences a lot, right? And when I talk to audiences about the number one thing that you think holds most people back from following the entrepreneurial life path, what do you think it is? Fear, right? Fear of failure, right? A lot of people, most people, are really scared of failure. So we asked the same question of the 55 people that we interviewed. And we said, what are you most scared of? The thing that they were most scared of was fear of regret, right? That's a pretty interesting transition, right? Fear of failure to fear of regret. And when you make that transition, the world's your oyster, right? Because you look at things in a very, very different way. So you have to be able to seize the the moment and take that action. And you also have to recognize the fact that it's not just about yourself, right? It's about making a difference in the lives of others. Finally, it's the idea of embracing renewal and reinvention. Recognizing the fact you've got to pick your head up frequently, daily, to be able to get those moments of reflection to figure out, am I on the right path or not? So really interesting research coming out of this. We had a fascinating time, had a great time writing the book. And again, just to reiterate on the entrepreneurial life plan, it's essentially that people have a deep sense of themselves. They're awake to the opportunities around them. They got a vision for where they want to go. They've got a set of goals and strategies to be able to pull that vision off, with recognizing the fact that there's a lot of spontaneity built into that. We talk about purposeful spontaneity. They also have a strong support network around them. They're willing to make that leap and go for it, take action, make a difference, and then keep on that path by embracing renewal and reinvention. So that path has essentially led me, through my research and through my teaching and through my work, to Duke, where I now run the Entrepreneurial Leadership Initiative, which is one of Duke's undergraduate social entrepreneurship programs. It's a lot of fun. I feel like I've got one of the best jobs at the university. And it's about harnessing all this talent, right? All this young, energetic talent that wants to go take on the world and make it a better place. And I love it. Love it. But what I've come to appreciate and what I've come to realize is that focusing just on creating really good seeds, really good entrepreneurial seeds, is not enough. We've also got to start paying attention to the fertile ground in which to plant these seeds, right? Because if these seeds end up in arid, rocky ground, if they end up in cities or communities that don't embrace that entrepreneurial spirit, they will wither. Or they will ultimately not flourish, they won't reach their potential, and we won't get the full amount of energy out of them. And in a place like North Carolina, that's really important that we keep that talent and allow it to flourish, right? Because let me provide a little bit of context about North Carolina. For those of you who don't know it, North Carolina was totally dependent upon three industries about 50 years ago, right? So the three industries, of course, were tobacco, textiles, and furniture. And the state leaders, the business leaders and the political leaders, had the great foresight to say, we are on a dead-end road with these three industries. There's no way that this state is going to flourish if we don't do something. So they took bold action, really interesting bold action, and they quietly bought up 5,000 acres of pine brush because it was located between three universities, right? Duke, UNC, and NC State. And they created a triangle. They decided to call it Research Triangle Park. And it was that vision and that fortitude and a little bit of cash that was able to start attracting the likes of IBM and a number of other research and development activities, to the point that that is now generating $1.8 billion a year in revenue back to the state, employs 40,000 people, and has a multitude of really neat R&D and patents that have come out of that. And it's been one of the biggest engines of growth for our state. So now we're in another interesting chapter in time that I've now entered into the conversation of, and I'm having a great time with it. So just when I was starting to think about this idea of seed and field, that I started to engage in this conversation in Durham to think about, how do we actually create intentionally that ecosystem within a city environment? And how do we create a new model of urban development? And how do we do it around the concept of change making? Right? So how do we create a city that embraces the idea of social innovation and entrepreneurship and intentionally captures, harnesses, and grows that energy? How do we do that? So that's what we're embarking upon now, and I want to share just a few thoughts on that. Why is this work important? The work is important because there is a lot of entrepreneurial energy out there. And what we've seen from the studies of Kauffman, for example, is that 2/3, if not more, of net new jobs are created by firms that are less than 5 years old, right? This is the future of our economy. And we can't, as we look at the future of our country, we know that we cannot borrow our way out of it. We can't spend our way out of it. We ultimately have to innovate our way out of it. So recognizing the fact that entrepreneurship is going to be one of our major growth engines and that we need to continue to innovate in order to stay ahead of the game, how do we do that? How do we do that in communities like Durham, for example? San Francisco, you guys have it made, right? Durham, we got to fight for it. And we're fighting for the talent to keep them from moving to San Francisco. And the best thing we got working for us is we got a better cost of living. That's for sure. We have also some great weather and a few other things that are working in our advantage. But we have all this entrepreneurial energy. But the challenge here is that most of our entrepreneurial energy, most of our entrepreneurs are not connected to one another. So they're often working in isolation, one. Two is that they often have a lack of resources and support in order to truly reach their potential and get to any kind of scale. That includes capital. I'll talk to them in a second. Three is that they don't have any active policy environmental support, right? So the policymakers are traditionally focused on hunting big elephants. So their traditional economic development model is, let's go get the next IBM. But what you recognize, in fact, there's a lot of really interesting work. A guy named Ronnie Chatterjee, for example, one of my colleagues at Duke, has done some great work on this, which basically shows that hunting elephants doesn't work because those elephants, as soon as there's another incentive that's one state away, will pick up and move, right? But if you plant thousands of entrepreneurial seeds and create a really intertwined, integrated, collaborative environment, those entrepreneurs will stay, they'll flourish, they'll grow, they'll create jobs, and they'll create impact. So how do we do that? How do we create that intentional environment? So with that in mind, we set out to create a comprehensive ecosystem focused on social innovation. And we did two different things. One is that we went and looked at all of the assets we had in our community and did a gap analysis. The second thing we did is we went and looked at best practices around the world, ranging from Helsinki to Pittsburgh to Indianapolis to San Francisco to Austin to Seattle to Providence, Rhode Island, to a number of other places, 13 cities in total. And we tried to learn as much as we possibly could from efforts around being able to harness that entrepreneurial energy. And what we came to realize is that there were a ton of really good ideas out there. But what was interesting is that nobody was taking a comprehensive approach to it. There were lots of incubators out there. So just around the corner from here, you all, I'm sure, are familiar, or most of you should be familiar with Hub Soma, which is south of Market. And it's a fabulous place. And in fact, tonight, there's the co-founder of Twitter speaking there. So otherwise, this place would be packed, I'm sure. And they're doing some really interesting things, but it's focused just on that community, right? So how do you come up with more of a comprehensive approach? Or how do we come up with better banking models and equity models to invest in these social innovators? So coming out of our research, we basically did two things. I raised a $100,000 planning grant, and I got money from key investors in our community, from the Chamber of Commerce, from the city, from our universities, from the local community foundation, business community, nonprofit community. And I did two things with that money. One is that I wanted to go and make this truly a community-led effort. And so we harnessed the talent of over 150 people to contribute to eight different working groups focused on eight different strategic interventions that we were interested in. The other thing we were interested in is getting a few early wins, because we knew that if we got early wins, that we could get some momentum around it, and it's exactly what's happened. So we ended up opening a 5,500-square-foot incubator in downtown Durham that was going to be the beginning of what I hope to be a 25,000-square-foot social innovation campus. So recently, we just rolled out a strategic plan, and I want to tell you about the four different things that we got focused on it. The first is really focusing in on how do we home grow talent in our community. So how do we create a pipeline of talent, and how do we create on-ramps of opportunity for people who are disenfranchised traditionally from the entrepreneurial dream, specifically people who come from the poorer communities in our city? And so we have a relationship with Durham Public Schools and with our local universities to figure out how do we both inspire that entrepreneurial energy and then give them the support, mentoring, and connections necessary for them to follow that path of being problem solvers so that we hope to retain them, right? Because when I graduated from Duke in 1993, nobody in their right mind stayed in Durham, right? It was a dying city. Today, it is on a path of an absolute resurgence and renaissance. And now we want to try and get as many of them to stay as possible because this is where our growth is going to come from, right? So it's both focused on talent development and retention. The other thing that we're focused on is talent recruitment. So we want to try and make Durham and North Carolina the best place in the world for people who want to change the world. And I'm going to arm wrestle you guys for this one because I think we can pull it off. Because of all the things I just mentioned, a vibrant community, a huge amount of creative clustering going on, great quality of life, and cheap to live in. And we feel like we can market that, right? And we can market that to all of these great college graduates who have big ideas for changing the world and say, come to Durham. Because if you come to Durham, you're going to be part of an intentional community. And we're going to invest in you, and we're going to support you, and we're going to scale you, and we're going to give you the capital you need to be able to succeed. And we want to tell that story far and wide. So as we're building that talent pipeline, right, home-growing it and recruiting it, then what do we do in terms of the venture enabling? How do we take organizations from seed to scale, which is what we're focused on? And we feel like there's a variety of different things. First and foremost is building that community, breaking down that isolation that I was talking about earlier, right? And one of the things I want to come back to in a couple of minutes is this idea of collaboration because it's so powerful. And seeing what's happening with the community building that's already happening. Two is mentorship, so peer-to-peer mentoring, peer-to-peer connections, mentoring, access to resources, right? Access to discounted resources like marketing, technology, bookkeeping, all the things you need as an entrepreneur, but you don't want to deal with. You also want access to cheap and expensive flexible space. You don't want to sign a 12 or 24-month or 36-month lease. It doesn't make sense at your stage of growth. So we want to provide that space, which is why we've opened the co-working space. Also access to talent. So we're launching a social venture directory that will have a jobs board attached to it to try and get university students that are looking for the jobs connected with the social enterprises that need that kind of talent. And then also we're launching what we hope in the next year, a $3 to $5 million social innovation fund. Put money into some of the most promising ideas in a combination between debt and equity. And I can break it down for you if you're interested in what that looks like. The final piece that we're doing, which we're really excited about, is the idea of also launching a think tank connected to this. Because we need to be able to show the kind of impact we're having in this community in terms of economic development and in terms of community impact. And we need to be able to translate that into a set of policy recommendations at the local, state, and federal level to be able to show the kind of impact we're having so that it becomes part of the economic development strategy of the city and state in particular, but also is able to attract resources from a federal perspective. And one of the things we have in spades, of course, in the Research Triangle and North Carolina writ large is academic talent. And how do you take the great academic talent of colleagues like Greg Dees, for example, who's my colleague over at the Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship, or Marianne Feldman, who's over at UNC doing some really interesting work on innovations and clustering. How do you get them to wrap their heads around this idea of creating ecosystems of social innovation and entrepreneurship? So those are the things we're engaged with at Bull City Forward. It's really exciting to be able to share that. And for those who are listening on the radio, you can just check it out at bullcityforward.org to get a little bit more information about it. I want to leave you with a couple of big questions and thoughts that I'm working through right now, which is one of the things that I think is holding us back in the social enterprise conversation is scale, right? And so we are chipping away, but only on the margins of some very big, hard, thorny questions. How do we break through that scale question? And I'm not convinced that that scale is going to happen at individual organizational levels. You may have a couple of breakthroughs, but even at the individual level, that's really, really difficult. What's ultimately going to happen is we have to create movements, right? We have to go back to what happened with civil rights, for example, where there was a few organizations that were driving it, but ultimately it became something much more than individual organizations. It became a collaboration of organizations. So there's the Center for Social Innovation, for example, which is out in Toronto right now. It's a 19,000-square-foot space. It's an incredible place. It's got 100,000 visitors that have come through there. And what the most interesting thing about that initiative, from my perspective, is that it has, through its communal efforts, has launched six citywide initiatives. right? So six initiatives that are geared around trying to get social innovators to work together to try and solve some of the city's hardest challenges. Some of the things that I also see, for those of you who are familiar with the Harlem Children's Zone, for example, and one of the things I'm excited about is the idea of the Promise Neighborhoods concept, right? I think that the Senate, incidentally, has made a drastic mistake by cutting funding for that because it's actually providing incredible opportunities for these organizations to be able to collaborate together to try and figure out how you can create better cradle-to-career solutions. Because one of the things that Durham does not need is any more organizations, right? It needs smarter organizations working together. To give you one quick data point on that, Durham is a city of 215,000 people. It's got 1,100 nonprofit organizations in it, right? That's one nonprofit for every 200 people. We don't need more nonprofits. We need more entrepreneurs to be able to work together to try and collectively figure out how to make this happen. So I'm really interested in the conversation around how do you create collaborative networks and how do you create movements out of those collaborative networks. One organization that I would encourage you to watch closely is going to be IBM. So IBM, those of you may be familiar, have put a lot of energy into smarter cities, and they've just now they've deployed some really interesting solutions in developing countries and developing cities, and they're going to start turning their attention domestically, and I think that is going to be fascinating to watch. The Knight Foundation similarly is invested in this idea of how do you create these interconnected networks around technology and media, building on the Knight-Ritter relationships and building things in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Miami, and just recently in Charlotte that are really interesting to watch as well. So as I think about this idea of how to bring things to scale, as I think about this idea of figuring out a way that we can do a better job of not only cultivating great seeds but planting them into fertile ground and helping them to grow, I'm figuring out how do we help them to grow into massive forests, right? Aspen trees that have interconnected root systems that ultimately thrive and flourish along the way. Because if we do that, and we do that well, I think we have a real shot at moving the needle on a bunch of key, really important things for our economy and for our society, and that in 50 to 100 years, I think we have a chance to do some real transformation. So I appreciate you taking the time now and look forward to some of the Q&A.
Our thanks to Christopher Gergen, social entrepreneur extraordinaire and a great inspiration to us all. I have a bunch of questions here, Christopher, and there's essentially two large groups and then several miscellaneous. So let's start with the big picture first.
Great.
You essentially use the term social entrepreneur, social innovator, and entrepreneur fairly interchangeably throughout your talk. But people want to know about money. So what's the relationship of profit to social entrepreneurship, social innovation, and entrepreneurship? And how do you differentiate between those three categories?
It's a great question, and I'm glad it was asked. So, money is important, and ultimately I think that we are moving in a direction where you are finding more and more companies become socially responsible and more nonprofit organizations recognizing the fact that earned income is a critical path to sustainability and ultimately to scale. We've got to get to a point where it's not only – we can't rely on philanthropy. We have to rely on market-based solutions for a number of different things. Now, here's an interesting question. There's lots and lots of research on earned income, and I'm not going to spend very much time on that. I'm going to be fascinated to see if there are increasing relationships and partnerships between for-profit companies and nonprofit organizations almost to the point of an M&A. For example, if you are a for-profit company that wants to dramatically increase your social impact in a particular area, does it make sense actually to take on a nonprofit or consolidate a number of nonprofit organizations and begin to invest in that and figure out a way that it can begin to generate revenues back. It's a model that I haven't seen yet, But I think it's coming down the pike. There are some great models out there. Most of you are probably familiar with B Lab and B Corp and B Corp certifications, all this idea of triple bottom line. Interestingly enough, we are making sure that every single one of our members, and interestingly enough, we're a membership-driven organization. That's our earned income strategy for Bull City Forward. It's a nonprofit organization. But our membership is about a half-half, for-profit, nonprofit. And what we're finding, what we want to do is with all of our members is run through a triple bottom line screen, because for-profits, again, need really good metrics around this. For example, there's a really interesting company in Durham that just raised a $40 million venture capital round, 250 employees, and they hired a director of corporate social responsibility. And because they're so wedded to B Corp, his job is basically to move them from an 82 to a 90 in the next year in terms of corporate responsibility. So he's got a scorecard, and he's got a variety of things that he needs to do to be able to make that happen. That's good. The other thing that really needs to happen is that much more financial rigor needs to be put into place in a lot of nonprofit organizations that we work with, and better strategies for earned income. All of that said is that access to capital is critical, right? So that's the reason I was talking about the Social Innovation Fund, is that there is a big valley of death between the friends and family round, where you go to hit everybody up to get a little bit of cash to start your organization, and getting any traditional financing. We got to solve that valley, right? We got to put a couple of oases into the mix. So the idea behind the Social Innovation Fund is to actually have earlier stage, riskier capital, and then the structure behind it is actually trying to create a fund that would be supported by principally a foundation, likely, because there would not be an expectation of financial return on investment. Because I think if you're trying to get financial return on investment you're gonna that's not, because it's earlier stage, it's riskier, it's going to be harder to pull off. That's the reason we're trying to create a revolving loan fund. And I actually ran a fund like this when I was at something called New American Schools, a $25 million fund to do that. It's pretty interesting to do it. But it's got to have some equity attached to it, too, because if you look at the financial models are, if you just have a revolving loan fund, that you eventually erode all of your capital, and you never actually get any returns to replenish the fund. So we want to actually have an equity piece that comes along with it, too. Wide-ranging answer, but there you go.
Okay, well, it's a good answer because it allows me to ask the next question. So this term social entrepreneurship, Christopher knows that this series that we're doing at the Commonwealth Club is going to be published as a book by Stanford University Press to try to get at this thing called social entrepreneurship. What, in your mind, is the difference then between a social entrepreneurial organization and just an effectively and well-managed nonprofit organization?
I think the key differentiator tends to be that of innovation. If you look at Greg Deese's definition of social entrepreneurship.
And by the way, Greg Deese is one of the foremost academic thinkers in this regard. He happens to be a colleague of Christopher's at Duke University. Right. Although he was at Stanford before, I just might add.
He was saying good things about Duke. And he was at Harvard before that, right? So on Harvard, Stanford, Duke, he worked his way up. With Greg, he basically talks about social entrepreneurship is that, you know, first and foremost, you have to be focused on creating social value. Two, you have to be relentless about pursuing new innovative solutions to be able to take on some of the hardest challenges, right? So I think that if it's an effective, well-managed organization, there are quibbles about whether you're innovative or not. If you're relentless in pursuing that, then, yeah, you're a social entrepreneur. And I'm not precluding, by the way, that there are some very well-established 100-year-old social entrepreneurial organizations or organizations that could become more social entrepreneurial. But I think the idea is that, or you can be more social entrepreneurial as well, because you see a lot of really interesting entrepreneurship things that are happening as well. You also are operating in resource-constrained environments, and you don't mind going for it if you feel like you don't have the cash to be able to pull it off. And then finally, you're holding yourself accountable for results, and you've got very clear assessments along the way. So if that effective, well-managed nonprofit organization is doing all those things, then they're social entrepreneurs.
Okay. Let me just take a moment to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our guest is Christopher Gergen, who is discussing social entrepreneurship. There's a bunch of questions about education, Christopher, and they come from a variety of different perspectives. So you know that Bill Drayton at Ashoka Believe has this saying now, everyone a change maker. Let me start with that. Is that true?
I do think that everybody has the capability of being a change maker, absolutely. And that's if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be doing the things that I'm doing now, right? So I'm working actively to try and awaken young people to the possibilities of being problem solvers in their communities and trying to take things on. Now, does that mean that everyone needs to be an entrepreneur? I don't think so. We don't need, as I mentioned earlier, we don't need another 1,100 nonprofit organizations. We need really sharp, innovative, awakened, resourceful, accountable individuals out there trying to make the world better. And so from all my work with Ashoka, having just been there yesterday, I think that they share that same philosophy, and I concur.
Okay. So the next question is, when do you infuse someone in the notion of entrepreneurship? And you know that in this country and around the world, many people are fundamentally uncomfortable with the notion of change. But entrepreneurship is about change. So how do you at least increase comfort levels around change? And when do you get people, at what point in their life and how do you get them to start thinking about the acceptance of change and the promotion of change?
So this is a really, really important, good question. By way of context, I was brought in at one point by UNC and by Kauffman Foundation to help develop a business plan for the North Carolina Center for Entrepreneurship Education. We were working with a school district out in eastern North Carolina around developing a whole entrepreneurial leadership development program. And there, we proposed starting in third grade. And the idea behind starting in third grade is that you can equip young people as early as third grade with the notion that their ideas matter, right? So you're challenging them to look at the community around them and think about what's right and what's wrong about that community and just probing for what that will look like. And, of course, their ideas become more developed and more advanced. Now, I'm going to say that, as saying that, that was about 4 years ago that I did that. I now have a 5.5-year-old, and I believe I'm equipping her now with the idea of having the entrepreneurial mindset. And I will hearken back to somebody that some of you should know. If you don't know, you should. Carol Dweck, we were talking about a little bit earlier today, who's at Stanford. And has done some terrific work on the growth mindset versus the fixed mindset. Essentially, the fixed mindset is that you are trapped by a set of expectations and you are afraid of taking risk and you follow the status quo, and that the growth mindset is one of where you continually believe you can do better, right? And you're looking for different ways to approach things. I equate, in many respects, the growth mindset and the entrepreneurial mindset. And if you look at Dweck's research, it suggests that we should start with my 2.5-year-old son.
Okay, well, I'm having a hard time getting my 16-year-old daughter to accept this concept. So
you should have started when she was 2.5.
I try. So you mentioned the hub, and it's an exciting initiative. But I was told by one of its leadership that all these people have all these great ideas, and it's really not necessary to learn about the failed initiatives of the past. So in terms of teaching, whether it's 2.5 or 5.5 or 16-year-old, or in your case, undergraduates at Duke, how much do you need to understand about efforts that have been tried in the past in order to accept change and be entrepreneurial going forward?
I think it's really helpful to understand the process of trying something and failing. But I think the most important lesson is what happens after failure, right? So if you stumble and fall, what happens right after that moment? So one of the things that I teach, and we shared in our book, and Peter Sims is going to share in his book, Little Bets, is the work, again, of Warren Bennis. And he talks about the crucible moment. And the metaphor behind the crucible moment essentially is the alchemists would use the crucible to be able to expose raw metals to very severe heat, and then from that severe heat be able to produce precious gold. And the metaphor essentially is that when you get exposed to that high heat, what happens to you? Do you turn into precious gold, or do you melt away? And he talks about it within the context of leadership. And I think the same thing is true of life. And so the more that we can, I think, provide and expose young people to that, give them opportunities to stub their toes through a process of not just teaching them about failure, but in my case, I actually have my students go out there and try and get entrepreneurial ventures off the ground. And when they do that, they quickly learn how difficult it is, and they inevitably hit some serious roadblocks and deep sense of, lack of confidence. I mean, these are young people who have basically been handed life on a silver platter in many respects. And I know this actually trying to raise kids, that, my wife and I have a very different tolerance for risk in terms of our kids. How much do we let our kids go? How much do we let them fail? And I think the more that we can provide them opportunities to, take a few knocks along the way and then help them learn from that experience and keep moving is extremely healthy.
Well, of course, you're sitting in Northern California, which is somewhat of an entrepreneurial place. And we all know that in Silicon Valley particularly, failure is considered a good thing. But would you say that that notion of failure has actually kind of moved into the social space as well, where if you've started a few nonprofits that have failed, it would be considered a good thing?
I do. It is a great question. I think that it is increasingly becoming part of the vocabulary. What's interesting, here's where I see most of my students failing and where I see most nonprofit organizations fail, which is they fail to ask, what problem am I trying to solve? Right? I have so many students come into my office and say, oh, I've got this amazing idea, right? It's going to do this and that, and it's going to do all these great things, and it's going to totally transform our community. And okay, what problem are you trying to solve? And they look at me with a blank stare. So the very first thing I do in my class is actually try and structure it around this idea of theory of change. Like, what problem are you trying to solve? What's the solution that you're trying to get there? And then what kinds of outcomes are you trying to achieve? From that perspective, I think we will be well served when we start learning more and more about organizations that have tried things and have failed. And interestingly enough, I think you're also going to see a lot of nonprofit organizations feel desperately like they got to launch an earned income venture and have no idea what they're doing, and they crash and burn, and it threatens the whole organization. So you're going to start seeing some really interesting lessons coming out of that work as well.
Okay. Let's look at the notion of collaboration, which you brought up. So if you're thinking about a for-profit model, you may not want to collaborate with a like organization or a like company that's trying to do exactly the same thing. And those of us who have been in the nonprofit world are familiar with the experience where you go to a foundation and they say, oh, you're doing X? Well, this organization, which you think of as your competitor, is also doing X. Why don't you just work together? And you think, well, actually, we're going after the same constituency. We're going after the same funding. It's not that comfortable for us to work together. So how do you take that for-profit notion of competition and apply it to collaboration in a useful way within this kind of new model?
Well, actually, I think it should apply more to for-profit companies, too. And B, my answer is, in being actually an active advocate of forced collaboration, is that I think we've got to align our investment in smarter ways. And we've got to be able to get to a point where we have a collective interest in where the outcomes are going and invest appropriately. And if people are not willing to play and are not willing to collaborate, then they shouldn't be part of that funding stream. I think way too often foundations are the ones to blame on this, and we're spending our money in a very thin way. It's promoting fragmentation, and it's not getting the job done in terms of where the problems are. I'm not sympathetic to the nonprofit leader that's got his or her elbows out because they feel like it's her turf or his turf. My sense is, let's get the best solutions out there and let's figure out a way to collaborate. Here's a quick example of this. It's really interesting to watch. Minneapolis St. Paul Community Foundation basically said that they're trying an experiment right now. I haven't been following it that carefully, but it basically says that we're trying to take on childhood obesity. And so they put out a pot of money and they called for proposals from across the city. And they got something like 96 proposals in about 36 hours to try and take on childhood obesity. And they basically said, okay, nobody's going to get the money until you start working together to solve it. And they're going to go through a collaborative facilitated process to try and figure out how that's going to happen. And I'm going to be fascinated to watch the results. But that's the kind of stuff I think that needs to happen more often.
Christopher, there's a question that there's a notion out there, and you can support it or disabuse us of this notion, that a lot of social entrepreneurs are fairly empowered people. And you spoke earlier that you have to be able to take a risk. But for unempowered people, it's hard to justify taking that risk if they need a job, they need to support their family, et cetera. Whereas if you have means, it's easier to become a social entrepreneur. You are working in Durham. You're close to the people. You're close to the students. How does this notion translate among people who are less empowered within society in terms of Ivy League education or even Duke or, that kind of...
Or even Duke. Right. Exactly. Stanford being the Duke of the West.
Right.
Quickly on that, what we see in Durham is that there is a sense of Maslow's hierarchy here,
right,
which is that there are lots of people in our community. So just by way of context, Durham is about, there's no majority, so it's about 45% African-American, 45% white, 10% Hispanic. Hispanic population is one of the fastest growing in the country. And we have a really wide range of economic disparity there. Among the more disadvantaged communities, you do see a lot of entrepreneurial activity. None of it is focused on social entrepreneurship because at this stage of the game, it's about providing for your family. And that's a process that I think we need to respect and we need to grow. But what we're seeing actually is that some of those organizations that we're starting to work with are starting to recognize that also if they do become, that they embed it in their business model from the get-go, that actually it can attract more customers, which will drive their business. There's a really interesting tire company, for example, in Chapel Hill, that because since they become a B Corporation, they've grown sales by 40%. I think part of that's an education, part of it is an appreciation, a respect, and being able to support those people where they are, mm-hmm. And be able to help and help empower them and provide them with a sense of self-efficacy and the ability to create a better future for themselves.
Okay, that's a great answer. Our thanks to Christopher Gergen for this talk and all your important work. We also want to thank our audiences here, live and on radio, television, and the internet. Today's program has been the fourth in the Commonwealth Club Social Entrepreneurship Series. Next one, October 7th. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.